And now for the main message, our pastor, Mr. Steve Buchanan.
For most of you, many years ago, you began to understand the Bible in a way that you had never imagined. And along with that understanding, as you moved towards baptism, and most of you have gone through that process, you began to recognize things that the Bible said to you, right? You had a church that explained not only your future in terms of your salvation, but on the more sobering side of things, you learned things about Bible prophecy, things that would happen in the future. And I'll bet that that was one of the primary hooks for most of the people that are in our church today, is the understanding about Bible prophecy. You received a calling about your own personal salvation and understanding what lies ahead for you from a perspective of your relationship with God. And you also, you also began to learn about what would happen to the world that you live in today. Am I correct? Am I hitting on a point that is resonating with you at this point? A principle of Bible prophecy is that those who are responsible need to receive a warning. And in an individual sense, when God called you, you received a warning about your life and about the need to change and about the need to repent. And so those are some of the themes that we have been speaking about. You learned about forgiveness as well. And that is a theme that God carries throughout the Bible and through history and also into the future. The purpose of this message today is to amplify this pattern throughout history and help us to understand the future of prophetic warnings in one area. In one area. Through the years, I have heard some people say, I don't like to hear about politics in church. People in our group, people in our fellowship, I think I understand where they are coming from, and I will try to help explain, at least in my opinion, why a number of folks may still feel that way within our fellowship, okay, just within our fellowship. And I'm going to be the first to say, hey, I could be wrong about this. That's why we have the messenger chat. That's why we have the opportunity for people to challenge the speaker and even sometimes disagree as long as we're not disagreeable. Does that make sense? If you fall into the category, I don't like to hear about politics in church. Oh, I probably put that in a pejorative way by making a face, so I apologize for that. I'm going to show you that you're wrong and why you should be concerned about politics, or maybe I should say government. Don't be offended, because I don't know who you are, especially those out there in cyberland. And if all is said and done, you're still offended, then my justification is, because I said so. All of you grew up with parents who may have said that. But first of all, let's understand what the true definition of politics really is, okay? Because when people think of politics, they often go to the default of another definition, and I'm going to get to that one as well. But politics simply means the art or science of government. That's from Webster's. There's a bunch of online dictionaries, and you can find similar definitions to that. That's the first thing when you, but our default is usually not that, right? We think of other things, maybe pejorative things, and I'll get to that in a second. Or the art or science concerned with guiding or influencing governmental policy. Now, when you look at strictly politics, it's just the action of governments. And all of us live under governments no matter where we are in the world. We have some governments that have traditionally been better places for which people can live and have freedom, and I think we all recognize that. In other places in the globe where maybe personal freedoms, individual liberties are not so great or through history have not been so great. But what most people think about when they think about politics or government is this: political activities characterized by artful and often dishonest practices. When people think about politics, my default most of the time is, when I think about politics, is the scheming, the manipulation, the use of the law to get around other laws, dishonest practices. Okay, you know what? If that's something you object to, you and I, are all in agreement. We are definitely in agreement, because we can all agree that dishonest practices, no matter who does them, whether it's a government official or just an average person, are wrong, and we should not like those things. And we see plenty of this in the world today. But as Christians and students of the Bible, we can't hide our heads in the sand and ignore the reality that goes on around us. And sometimes, yes, even in church, we have to discuss those issues to help us to understand the world that we live in and the world as it will become in the future, and then in the hopefully not so distant future when Christ returns and takes over all of this mess and the governments of this world. Okay, that is the preface. That is the introduction. I'm just going to say it one more time. If somehow or another, in your crazy little mind, you're still offended by sermons or illustrations of the governments of this world, don't get mad at me. Take it up with my friends, the prophets. That's the title of the sermon today. My friends, the prophets. I'd like you to begin today in 1 Samuel chapter 8. And when I began, 1 Samuel 8 and verse 4, and I'm going to be covering verses 4 through 7, and I know that I'm automatically going to score some points because I don't always give the total number of scriptures that I give, and so I apologize for that. And I will say that in my own little way, I am trying to change. Sometimes I don't change quickly enough. So we'll begin today in 1 Samuel chapter 8 and verse 4. And with a preface to that, while you're turning, remember that Samuel had a very unusual upbringing. He was brought up basically in the tabernacle of God. He was brought up by, for the most part, Eli, who was a judge and a priest in Israel. This is prior to them having kings. And his mother had dedicated him to the service of God. And so at this time, when we pick up the story, he is a full-grown adult, and he is serving in a threefold capacity: as a priest, as a judge in Israel, and as a prophet. And he's just an amazing personal study. If you're ever interested in just going back to the beginning and looking at his life, it is unbelievable in terms of, and I'm not saying he didn't have faults, because obviously he had his faults, but we'll begin this story about my friends, the prophets, in this particular chapter. And you'll remember at this time, now he's an older man. We've gone through many, many years, many, many decades of his life, and he doesn't have long for this world, and he knows it. And so in verse 4, all the elders got together and they came to Samuel, and they may have had some ins in terms of being able to criticize him as an individual, because his sons weren't following him. And he was kind of negligent in correcting them at some points of his life. That's another story. But they had problems as the elders of all of the tribes. They got together and they said, we want to have a king just like everybody else. They didn't have a king. They were ruled by judges for over 400 years. And a lot of the times that particular system of governance worked out pretty well because there were some really great righteous judges. But now we're coming to the end of the line. And now we're coming to the time in which the line of the succession of kings of Israel would be introduced. Now, this did not sit well, as you know, in reading through this story with Samuel. He knew it was a wrong decision. He knew the people were making a wrong mistake. And he said in verse 6, but the thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king. So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you. They have rejected me that I should not reign over them. God saw right through the entire strategy. Even at this point, early on in the history, you know, they'd been in the land for about 400 years or so, and they had departed from God. You read the book of Judges. When they depart from God, God would send a judge. The people would get back on track, and there'd be this cycle. Then they would rebel after a while against God, and then God would send nations to oppress them. And, you know, it's an incredible study, the book of Judges itself. But God always provided people to help guide them and lead them out of apostasy and so on and so forth. But God said, look, just go along with it. This is the only way they'll learn. And they're probably not even learn that way. Verse 8, according to all the works which they have done since the day that I've brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. God relented. He gave the people what they wanted. So in verse 22, we read, sorry, lost my place there. Now Samuel took, verse 22, wrong chapter. So the Lord said to Samuel, heed their voice, make them a king. And Samuel said to the men of Israel, every man go to his city. And so the process whereby God would reveal who the next king began. And it's a very interesting study and a story of and by itself. But this began the reigns of kings over Israel. God allowed the people to have a king, but from the beginning, there is a theme which is very important for students of the Bible to recognize. And that is, even though there would be a king over the civil activities, for the most part, of the nation of Israel, God provided a counterpoint always through the history of Israel. And that counterpoint to the king, the manner in which God chose to correct the governance, or at least attempt to correct the governance, or to warn the king that he was going off, or that the nation was going off in the wrong direction, was through the office of the prophets. And you see this theme through the entire history of the combined kingdoms, Israel, the 12 tribes, and then when they split, the 10 tribes to the north and the tribes Benjamin, Levi, and Judah to the south. You may say, well, it's 13 tribes, but we'll explain that later at another time. But the point is, God provided a division of power and always provided a warning directly to the civil government that was in place and that he allowed. The prophets stood many times against the tyranny of kings. Because when you look through much of history, up until the establishment of the United States of America in the 1700s, basically, that's how people were ruled all through history. It was by the divine right of kings. And after the dispersion of Israel and the captivity of Israel and Judah into their respective captivities, then nations carried on with this attitude that, you know, the king is there because God put him there, and that's how kings acted. Like, you know, whatever laws we want to make, we just do. It doesn't really matter what the people want. And so the divine right of kings held for centuries. Really. I mean, the American experiment, and to a lesser degree, what happened in the Commonwealth of Nations in the United Kingdom, is a blip in the history of mankind. And I think all of us appreciate the fact that as Americans, we have grown accustomed to the kinds of liberties that no one else in history enjoyed. But during the time of Israel, at any rate, God provided a counterpoint, sometimes a very stern counterpoint, when a king would begin to go off base. And the prophets warned them specifically of what was going to happen to them if they did not change direction. Now we know, we're studying through some of those prophets called the minor prophets in our Bible study, we know that most of the time kings did not listen. Now you can read through the warning that Samuel gave in chapter 8 about all the things that the king is going to do. You know, he's going to initiate a taxation upon you. He's going to take the best of your young people for his armies and for his own service. He's going to do this because that's what kings do. And you know what? Samuel was right. Everything that he said came true. God allowed it, but important for us to remember in our present day and age, in my opinion, is that God provided a counterpoint against the tyrannical reign of kings and their disobedience to God by warning them, oftentimes in a very powerful way and a very personal way, through the office of prophets. And they are too numerous to even begin to mention. I've thought that as I was preparing earlier in the week for this sermon, I thought this might make a good extended Bible study to cover as a topic, and maybe I'll do that. But sometimes kings listen to the prophet. Let's take a look at one king that listened and one king that did not. First, let's turn to 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 22. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 22. This is with the first king that was chosen, Saul. And there's a transformation that took place in his life that is unbelievable as time went on during the reign of Saul, even at the point when he had disqualified himself, as this particular chapter shows, 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 22, that when he began to disobey Samuel, when he began to disobey God, then God slowly but surely began to remove his Holy Spirit from Saul because of disobedience, and one of the great lessons of the Bible. 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 22, I'm not going to go over the details of the disobedience, not pertinent here, not going to go over that at this point, just that he disobeyed the order of God, the order of Samuel. He tried to justify it, and you'll see that all through the reading of this chapter. Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offering and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king." Now, I didn't have David prepared yet. David would prepare, and he would serve in the court of Saul for a period of time, and then he would succeed Saul, and Saul would die in battle. It's a very sad story. It's a very, very sad story indeed. But Samuel was the counterpoint, the first counterpoint to the tyrannical reign of kings. And this is a theme that carries on throughout the Bible. And after Israel went into captivity, and then after Judah went into captivity, later on in Judah, there were other prophets, there were other holy men that worked with the people that came back to Judah, the Jews who came back to Israel from captivity. But they were still men of God that were there. I mean, during the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, they kind of finally, Judah got their act together and learned from the mistakes of their forefathers for a while. And then eventually that kind of faded, but that's the story of the Bible. Here's the story of a king who did obey when the prophet came to him. 1 Kings chapter 12, kind of an embarrassing situation. You see the attitude that Saul had. It's not the point of the 1 Kings chapter 12, and we'll skim through verses 1 through 13. Most of you are pretty familiar with this story in 1 Kings chapter 12. Oh, I'm sorry, I have got the wrong chapter here, and I must go back here. I apologize. I'm very sorry. I don't know why, but I sometimes do that, as you know. Hold on here. I think I know where I've made my mistake. Okay. Let's see. Give me just a second. Okay. I am very sorry for that. This is actually 2 Samuel chapter 12. So forgive me. This is an instance when a prophet of God was sent to as a counterpoint to the tyrannical rule of the king, the divine right of kings, and David was acting in this way. And we know the story of David sending Bathsheba's husband into the heat of the battle in order to get him killed, and so we won't go over that. But it was just the most horrible thing that can be done, right? But in 2 Samuel chapter 12, it says, "Then the Lord sent Nathan to David," verse 1. "And he came to him and said to him, 'There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb which he had bought and nourished. And it grew up together with him and with his children. It ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man who refused to take from his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. So David's anger was greatly aroused against the man. And he said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die.'" It was a parable that the prophet was giving. "And he shall restore fourfold to the lamb because he did this thing, and because he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, 'You are the man.'" Now we know that David's repentance is the subject of Psalm 51. And David was cut to the quick because he knew he shouldn't have done that, and he had justified it because he was the king. But he did repent. The difference between he and Saul was Saul justified his sin, Saul justified his actions, Saul went on and would not admit his mistake. Earlier in his life, he had been humbled. And he had not even thought himself to be worthy. But Samuel told him, when you were little in your own eyes, that's when God was able to work with King Saul. When he was humble, when he had a repentant attitude, something snapped in him. And it's really unfortunate, but it's a study and something that you can look at and maybe review, even during the time of preparation for the Passover season. The point is that God deals with leaders through warnings. He did that through the history of Israel. And you'll find that through the history of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. Here's just a short list of some of the initial kings of Judah and Israel and the prophets. Some of them you may not have even remembered or maybe even not even heard of. But God sent prophets to each of these individuals. There was Jeroboam and Rehoboam, who had the prophets, among others, of Ahijah and Shemaiah sent to them. There was Ahab, who was king over Israel, one of the most evil kings of all of Israel. And when, just as a hint, when you are studying the kings of Israel, that is the nation of Israel, Samaria, the northern kingdom, as the Bible calls it, they didn't have any righteous kings. They were all wicked and evil. And probably the reason for that is because at their beginning, they departed immediately from the holy days of God and set up alternative festivals, sometimes a month later after the Feast of Tabernacles, and adopted pagan practices and principles. And so every single one of the many kings of Israel from the time of the division of the kingdom with Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the way down to the time that they went into captivity, they were all evil. Every single one of them. There were some good kings in the history of Judah, but some of them were pretty evil too. One of the most evil of all kings was King Manasseh. He was probably one of the worst in terms of both kingdoms, Israel and Judah, and horrible, horrible things that he did. It was an interesting life study for him. But Ahab was a king of Israel, one of the most evil kings of Israel. And of course, you know that Elijah went to him, and then his successor Jehu was confronted by Elisha. Then Hezekiah, who was a king in Judah and a fairly righteous king for the most part, had Isaiah in his court, one of the major prophets, and Josiah, who actually rediscovered the law at some point and became a righteous king, had a prophetess advise him during his reign. Her name was Huldah, and she was a prophetess in the city of Jerusalem. So that's a small sampling of times in which the kings of Israel had personal contact with men of God who came to them, the civil leader who was engaged in politics and government and the orchestration of law, civil law. When he would go off base, God would send a prophet to that individual. And in the cases of the kings who were righteous, prophets came to them to help encourage them to continue to do the right thing and to advise them to do the right thing. This is just a few. The truth is, you cannot find a time in Bible history when there wasn't a prophetic warning to kings or the government officials. And sometimes it applied not only to the nations of Israel, but as you know, with the work of Daniel, it applied to pagan kings. And in their courts, that's just another entire story. Now, I said that I would try to explain why it is that I think there is sometimes, not a universal principle, there is sometimes within the Church of God an attitude that people, I don't want to hear about politics and church. I just want to hear about the Bible. Okay, well, I'm trying to explain the Bible to you, and I'm trying to explain current events. And I'm not saying that the movement is strong or big, but I've heard the comment from time to time. We have sometimes, or some of our people have sometimes thought it is wrong to speak out about governments or politics or even politicians. I have really tried to harness myself and not name names. And so I'm really going to try to do that today as well. If you name names in your own head, I think that's fine. I mean, it's okay for you to do that. But I guess I don't want to do that, not because I'm scared of retribution, but maybe it's not so classy. I've done it in the past. I'll admit, maybe I've been wrong. So maybe. Maybe. But we have thought for several reasons it's wrong to speak about some of these things, about politicians or governments or politics, and I'll tell you why. One reason is this, and it goes all the way back to 1954. I may have mentioned this to you once before. Well, years ago, when I was a festival coordinator of a large site for many years, not Ralph Helge, who is a really great guy and was a legal counsel, but other legal counsel within the church, you know, going back to the early 90s, advised the festival coordinators and the rest of the ministry, and sometimes I think it was mentioned on the refresher program for the ministers, that we should not use any kind of political speech in church. And we were forbidden to do that, even though I'm sure that we sometimes transgress that kind of advice. And it was based on the fact that we could possibly lose our 501c3 status as a tax-exempt organization. And so we were kind of cautioned as pastors, festival coordinators, not to engage in political talk, blah, 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 during services. So I'm sure that many of you did not ever know about that admonition to the ministry, but I'm telling you that at various times it came up. And it was based on an amendment that President Lyndon Johnson proposed in 1954. And it began to be applied to churches of all things, which is, when I explain to you the history, you're going to say, well, that's ludicrous. Why should that apply to churches? Here's the background. Unless you think, hey, I don't have any skin in the game, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a history lesson that we discovered in 2005 when Terry's parents had their 50th wedding anniversary, and I was researching Terry's great-grandfather, Otto Stolle, and he lived in Austin, Texas. He was a prominent businessman, and he ran for Congress in, I think it was 1926, and he ran for Congress against a man in Travis County, Texas, who had been a longtime incumbent, and in fact, in Travis County, which then was a very liberal county and still is today. Terry's great-grandfather kind of had no chance to get elected, but he ran anyway. Otto Stolle ran against James Buchanan. James Buchanan only got 90% of the vote, and he barely won the election, and he served in Congress until his death in office, and he was replaced by Lyndon Baines Johnson, who, you know, served in government forever after that, right? So this same Lyndon Baines Johnson came along, and in 1954, he was opposed by a prominent rancher and oilman in the Congress of the United States. So he slipped in an amendment to another law that prohibited nonprofit organizations for advocating for political candidates. It just so happened that there was a fairly large group of donors to a 501c3 organization, a nonprofit organization, that sent out letters to all the voters in that district and encouraged them to vote for the opponent of Lyndon Johnson. So crafty Lyndon Johnson inserted this amendment that any organization that would do that would potentially lose their tax-free status. You see what he was trying to do? This is the politics that most people hate, right? He was trying to get at his opponent by using the power that he had available to them. And, of course, he succeeded. Now, it also, since churches, many of them are tax-exempt organizations, it, through the years, began to be applied to churches. So if you didn't know the background, Lyndon Johnson didn't even mean it to apply to churches. But that's how the IRS began to apply it. And that's why we were cautioned not to have political speech in the Church of God. So that's one of the things. And it's all kind of a misunderstood, I think, even at that time by our church in the early 90s, because what Johnson wanted to do was to prevent nonprofits from participating in political activity. We have never done that anyway. We had never done that as a church organization. So I think it's important to know the basis of the Johnson Amendment, which forms some of the basis of our kind of generalized directive in the Church of God of kind of not speaking about out about this or that or labeling this or that. So going forward, in May 4th, 2017, President Trump signed an executive order that rescinded the ability of this law to be used to club churches over the head, basically. It was an executive order that was called Promoting Free Speech and Religious Liberty. And it was signed in the Rose Garden in 2017. Now, for all I know, that executive order may have already been rescinded by another executive order by the successor president, which would also limit. But there should have been shouting from the rooftops, and there was for many, many churches at that time, that a president signed this executive order, which basically didn't become law because things don't become a law in this country unless the Congress enacts them. But it was designed to limit the IRS from punishing churches should they maybe say, I like this guy instead of that guy. Okay? That simplifies it. When we look to governments, I'm just going to make a general principle statement here. When we look, taken to its extreme, when we look to governments to approve our speech, that is the day when we have a government church. And that's kind of strictly forbidden by the Constitution of the United States. But I think that a lot of us can look down the line and see the potential for that happening. The prophets took their message directly to the kings and the leaders of government. Now, another reason, now I know that, look, I'm going to cover this, even though I know that there may be some general disagreement, because we have had this particular passage explained to us over and over and over again throughout the many years many of us have been in the church. And if my explanation, which is a counterpoint to that, does not make sense to you, we can still be friends. I think. Turn to Daniel chapter 4. And verse 17. I hope we can be friends. I've touched on this before. I'd like to add to that previous explanation. Because as you're turning there, this particular passage that has to do with Nebuchadnezzar's reign has been extrapolated to apply to all situations through history. Generally speaking, okay? Does that make sense? It is, and sometimes there are general explanations that are valid and true. Now, it's just a personal opinion. I don't believe this is a general statement that applies to every situation in life after studying it very closely and understanding the very, very close relationship that the prophet Daniel had in the court of the Babylonian king, which was the most powerful at the time. And as you know, Daniel was called upon to solve the riddle of several dreams that were troubling the king, and this was one of them. And so Daniel comes in, And in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 7, without getting into the specifics of the dream, basically, Daniel's explaining to him, you're going down, buddy. You are going to be driven mad, and that's the meaning of the dream, and your kingdom is going to be taken from you. He interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream correctly, the way God told him to. He said, this decision is by the decree of the watchers and sentenced by the word of the holy ones. That means angelic messengers brought this message to Daniel to explain to Nebuchadnezzar what's going to happen in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. Now, this particular passage has been used to show that God is the one that puts all officials into power and allows them to rule. Now, the latter part of that, I would agree. Anybody that serves in a position of leadership as a king or a president or a prime minister or whatever is allowed by God in that office. But I believe that it is an error to suggest that God chooses every single leader through history, because we had always explained to us that from the time of Genesis 3, when mankind made his decision to go against God and disobey God, that God has had what? Approach to mankind. Generally speaking, hands off. Go your own way. You're going to reject my commandments. And it began with Adam and Eve, and that has been the history of mankind. So it would seem to me, and I'm not trying to convince you, because reasonable people can disagree with this without being disagreeable with one another or without losing friendships. It seems to me inconsistent with the hands-off policy that God would choose every leader. I mean, how far down do you take that? To dog catcher? I don't think so. So go back into the verse, and you'll see that the statement that that Daniel explains, he says this decision that he would lose his kingdom by decree of the watchers or the angels and the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. Verse 18, this dream, in summation, afterwards, after he came back to his senses, Nebuchadnezzar said, I have seen, and you've explained this to me, so I believe that this is a one-off. When Daniel had a close relationship, God inserted Daniel into a pagan king's court to be a counterpoint, as he did with all other prophets through history. Now, there have been instances of divine intervention that are noted in the Bible, and these exceptions are noted. Like Isaiah, where is my verse here? Isaiah, I had it highlighted here. Yes, Isaiah chapter 44 in verse 28. You can just jot it down and look it up later. I'll tell you what it says. God said through the prophet Isaiah hundreds of years prior to his birth that Cyrus would be somebody that he would use as his instrument, and he did. Cyrus was the one who defeated the Babylonian Empire, came in through the river Euphrates, and all that is prophesied hundreds of years by Isaiah prior to the fact. Okay, you know, it doesn't really matter if we agree on this last point that I have made or not. I'm just adding it because I want you to be stimulated. You know, sometimes if you don't have maybe a contrary point of view, then you're not stimulated to think. I want you to think, even if I'm wrong and you're right. And I don't have any problem admitting it. If somebody were to prove to me that I'm wrong, I have no problem in that at all. But this king was warned, and he was counseled by one of God's greatest prophets. And you find this theme all through history, and I encourage you. In fact, I challenge you in your own personal study to carry through this theme as you're studying the prophets and see that They are sent to the leaders of the world. They are sent to the leaders and the kings and the influential people of their world. And those people deserve a warning from God, just as you got when you were called. Now, they may be some of the most unrighteous people, like Manasseh was and other horrible kings of Israel. He was of Judah. But they deserve to be warned by God, even if they have no intention of repenting, even if they're so far gone. Isaiah chapter 3 and verse 12 is a passage, and you'll find many of these passages, and we will find some of them today in our Bible study later on. Isaiah 3 and verse 12 says, "Those who lead you cause you to err." This is a message to the people of Israel through Isaiah. Those who are leading you cause you to err. Other translations bring out that they confuse, they destroy your direction, or they make it difficult for you to go in the proper direction. They mislead you, they turn you away from what is right. Now, in our world today, how many examples can you find? You can find a lot of examples of our worldly leaders misleading people, and especially if you understand the dynamic of the descendants of the nation of Israel into this present day age, in this modern age, you can see plenty of examples of that in our world today. How many times have leaders objected to what is obviously wrong? How many leaders have objected to the sin, and we as our church call it a sin, the sin of abortion? How many worldly leaders have stood up and addressed this particular issue? Okay, let me ask you this question. Do you know, in terms of our nation, because we had a landmark decision in 1972 called Roe versus Wade, how many presidents do you think actually ever have addressed the right to life movement, which gets together every year in a convention and advocates for the overturning to the Supreme Court of this law? How many presidents have actually addressed that convention and given their support to that noble group? Exactly one. Now, some of them have kind of talked the talk and said nice things and said, and some haven't since 1972. Some have never, they've just stayed away from it because they agree with abortion. But there has been one president that has made a statement supporting those people, which is the right thing to do. So when the prophets of old speak out against the leaders who take bribes and don't know justice and who oppress the poor, all of which has been happening for years and is almost a daily notation in our news today, why can we not speak out about these heinous crimes as a church and as ministers of this church to people who are responsible for killing millions? Why should we be afraid of that? We should not. Why should we be afraid of IDing those who oppress the entire planet with sometimes their very selfish and obnoxious desires, their spiteful and vengeful policies and programs that are designed to purposely harm people and to hurt their freedoms and to enslave them? These same individuals that God has set free through his law and given them personal freedoms. Take a look at this particular principle in Ezekiel chapter 33. Ezekiel chapter 33. Now, if you're with me so far and with me and maybe kind of a little bit of an agreement on the fact that there is this theme through the Bible that God corrects individuals who are responsible for setting the policy, the tone, and the direction of a nation, then it makes sense that this also should be a principle that could be followed in Ezekiel chapter 33 and verse 7. This is the watchman chapter. Son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore, you shall hear a word from my mouth and warn them for me. When I say to the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die, and you do not speak to warn the wicked man from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. It seems to me that wicked people deserve the same godly intervention as you good people sitting in the audience today. Make no doubt about this. There are warnings in the Bible that go far beyond the political and governmental leaders. There are warnings to the individual citizens, and we all know that. But the kings, the presidents, and the prime ministers are not exempt from the warnings of God, and they must be given that warning. And what is the message to them? Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10. This is just a general principle as a warning. They need to hear it too, and I can guarantee you that they will hear it. They're not going to be left out. Deuteronomy chapter 10 and verse 12, it says, "And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul?" And if you look through the Bible, you'll see that there are times when the prophets went to the kings of Judah, and they tore their clothes because they were so upset with themselves and what had happened in the nation. And they repented, and God relented, at least for a little while, of the damage that he intended to bring upon those people. Amos chapter 6. I'm not going to overload you with a bunch of passages that talk about how the leaders of our world are the most culpable of all individuals. But they're in that position of authority and power. And in Amos 6 and verse 1, we had just studied this particular book. It says, "Woe to you who are at ease in Zion and trust in Mount Samaria." Samaria was the capital of the northern kingdom. And Israel was at the height of its power. The 10 tribes, the northern kingdom, was at the height of its power after the reign of Solomon. And there are people who are trusting in the government. "Notable persons in the chief nation to whom the house of Israel comes." This message is to them, the leaders. Okay, the prophet said, "Go over to Calneh and see from there to Hamath and the Great. And go down to Gath and the Philistines. See what I did to those nations. Are you better than these kingdoms, or their territory greater than your territory?" No. They're not. The people can trust in their leaders, but the leaders, you'd better repent because of your culpability, because it says in verse 7, "Of the leaders, therefore they shall now go captive as the first of captives. Those who recline at the banquets shall be removed." So yes, they deserve to be told and taught and at least warned. And this book is to the house of Israel, to modern Israel today. And I'm here to tell you that many of our leaders in the house of Israel, and that would be the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, are absolutely corrupt. Corrupt as you can believe and you cannot even imagine, because it is very difficult for you to see that corruption in the modern media stream today. It is very difficult to uncover that. But you can find it if you look in the right sources. These individuals are destroying the heritage of God. They need to be warned. They are destroying God's people through bribes and payoffs from foreign nations. And if you live in these nations, you should know that the day of the reckoning of those leaders is going to come. God says so. And you should know how diabolical their plans are that oftentimes have a very central source. Now, there is a very significant prophecy, I think, has more significance now than it ever has, and I've highlighted it, I've talked to you about it on several occasions. It's found in the book of Micah in chapter 5. And this is a prophecy that takes in kind of a wide scope in some ways, but it talks about the time of the end. I believe that this passage has never been more significant or has more applicability, not the best word, sorry, than the time of today. Because Micah chapter 5 and verse 7 says, "Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples." Remnant means, in this case, those left over or those preserved. As you study this chapter, let me give you a little bit of a hint. As in many cases of Bible prophecy, the context and the time frame can change dramatically and abruptly. Verse 2 speaks about the coming Messiah, for instance, coming out of Bethlehem. That's obviously the first coming of Jesus Christ. And verses 3 through 5 speak about the remnant of his brethren in the thousand years. Verses 3 through 5 talk about after the time of Christ's return. So that's different than verse 7, which I began with. The latter part of verse 5 is a time yet future. Let's read verse 5. It says, "And this one shall be in peace." Back up just a bit. In time frame, when the Assyrian comes into our land. Wow, what's an Assyrian going to come into our land for? "And when he treads in our palaces, then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princely men." The use of the term, according to Expositor's Bible commentary, the use of 7 and 8 means that these are to be understood as an indefinite number of leaders. So looking into the future, the destruction of Israel, where will there be an indefinite number of leaders who will come to provide salvation at the time of Christ's return? Who will rescue modern Israel from the clutches of a foreign power? Well, at Christ's return, this is just a thought, Jesus Christ returns with 10,000s of his saints. But that's just an aside. The context and the time shifts once again in verse 7. And according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the remnant is a comparative smallness to many people. I believe Micah 5 through 7 and 9 is one of the most important prophecies of our time right now, because what have we seen over the past 100 years? We have seen that the descendants of Jacob have ruled over the world. They have provided safety in some cases, and when they're provoked, they are like lions in the forest. They're like an incredible lion among all the rest of the beasts, and that would be the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. They've all gotten together. They all come from a common heritage, and this remnant has been a blessing, as it says, to all the nations, verses 7 through 9. And in verse 9, it says, "Your hand shall be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off." And that happened for a long time in our history. Sometimes it did not happen. Sometimes the United States, who's the preeminent nation in terms of power, has not used its power wisely at all. We go back, Korea as a war should have been won. It's kind of natural after World War II. We didn't want to use all the power that was available to us after nuclear holocaust in Japan. Vietnam, it looks like ditto to that. That should have been won. There's no reason that but some of the leaders of our day kind of prolonged the war for their own various reasons. And then we've had the most recent entanglements in the Middle East. And probably looking back over the history, a lot of people would come to the conclusion, you know, we shouldn't have been there to the extent that we were, but that's all past now. Let's close with this particular prophecy in chapter 6 of Micah and verse 2. It says, "Hear, O you mountains," which is, mountain is a synonym oftentimes for governments. "Hear, you governments, the Lord's complaint, and you strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a complaint against his people, and he will contend with Israel." That is going to happen. It's going to be directed at the policies, the governments of this world. God's warning is going to come to them. You can't escape the fact that governments are mentioned in the Bible. You can't escape the fact that God has set a system in place in which he will warn people who are incredibly evil of their wrong ways. In fact, it is impossible to preach the gospel to all nations without an indictment for individual and national sin. We are living in a time in which many leaders in many fields have departed from God. They are breaking laws and commandments in order to have their own financial gain or their own power. I could be more specific and detailed about the sins of leadership. We all have sin, right? I can document how the prophets of thousands of years ago have identified the issues of today. But it is our duty. It is our duty, and it is our moral obligation to speak out against these things. And if you examine the stern warnings and the indictments given to ancient kings, what I've said today is pretty mild by comparison. Do your own study. We have a moral imperative to identify and urge all leaders to repent of their course of action, which is against humanity, just like my friends, the prophets, did.